Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1980s, Jaron Lanier was a digital pioneer, visionary, enthusiast, gave us the phrase virtual reality, plunged into the early internet, loved it. Now, he's not so sure. This computer programmer, composer, and big thinker is afraid that Web 2.0 has gone wrong. Forgotten the individual, aggregated everything and everyone, reached for the wisdom of crowds, and come up a little empty, a kind of scary. This hour, On Point digital pioneer Jaron Lanier's new manifesto on where the web's gone wrong. You can join the conversation. Do you see it? Cyber reductionism, web users reduced to digital peasants, lost in the crowd or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear later in this hour from another manifesto writer, David Weinberger, co-author of the Clue Train Manifesto, with a different perspective. But joining me right now in the studio is digital guru Jaron Lanier. In the early 1980s, he founded VPL Research, the first company to sell virtual reality products. He's a programmer, composer, entrepreneur, collector of rare musical instruments, public intellectual, and all-around big thinker. He's out with a provocative new book called You Are Not a Gadget, a Manifesto. Doug Rushkoff says the book will, quote, be remembered either as the manifesto that rescued humanity from the brink of extinction or as the last cogent missive from an obsolete species. Jaron Lanier, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much.
Well, okay, you've got a little bit of apocalyptic terms in here. You've got digital Maoism and digital peasants and all the rest. But I'm wondering what happened. You know, the last time we sat down together was, I think, 20 years ago, last year, late 80s, Palo Alto. I was reporting on this thing nobody had ever heard of called virtual reality. You were doing it. And I didn't sense much of any reticence about the digital revolution. You were gung-ho on board, fired up, pretty happy, having a good time.
Yeah, well, hey, I'm still gung-ho about the internet. I love the internet, and I love technology. I'm totally committed to it. It's hard to get a bit of subtlety across in this, because mm-hmm. if I criticize one thing, a lot of people hear me as criticizing the whole thing, and that's completely wrong.
No, we know you're not. I mean, you dedicate the whole book to my friends and colleagues in the digital revolution.
Yeah. So the stuff that I think is bad is when we anonymize people, mash up their voices, and then sell it all back to them for an advertising service, just to be blunt about it. And that's the pattern that's evolved. And if you do a little bit of it, it's totally harmless, and you can participate in it to a degree, and it feels fine, and people enjoy their Facebook, and they enjoy their Twitter and all that, and that's all fine. Mm-hmm. But in the aggregate, a lot of things start to go wrong, and some of them are people stop getting paid to be intellectuals. And that's a big deal because, just to put it bluntly, when the robots get good, and they will get good, everybody will be an intellectual because you won't have to do physical work anymore. I mean, this mm-hmm. is just the trajectory that we're on. And so
carpenters will be mainly about thinking about what it should be, not necessarily about making it.
Exactly. And so if we don't get this right now, then we're just going to be impoverishing more and more people as technology gets better until we finally get it right.
Let's back up before we get to the economics and get to this. You say that with Web 2.0, there was a kind of big turn taken. And it's brought us to something more like a collectivist dynamic on the web, what you call, maybe others as well, a hive mind, as in beehive, like a lot of little drones.
Yeah.
What do you mean? What's the collective hive mind?
The idea of the hive mind is an almost religious idea that a lot of people take seriously, that the internet is coming alive as an organism, and that we should nurture it as if it was in a sense more important than us. Larry Page from Google has said he thinks it's coming alive. Obviously, people like Ray Kurzweil.
Who thinks he'll live forever when he can upload himself, basically.
And so it does become almost this religious fervor. And so essentially, a lot of technologists have taken on this feeling that the technology is a religious object.
And it's not the individuals who matter, but the wisdom of crowds, the collective
right.
mental presence turned into bits and bytes.
What you do when you start a religion is you take the holy book of the religion and you anonymize it. So this is exactly what happened with traditional holy books, Bible, Torah, and so forth. Mm-hmm. You forget the original authors and you pretend it has this oracle status that's greater than any human being. And that's exactly what we're doing with the internet. We're sort of trying to erase the sources, and the sources are real people, in order that we can kind of deify the thing and treat it as being bigger and better than us.
Make this real for us. We're way up there now at the deification of a kind of a world mind or hive mind. How does going on to Google and searching for, bran muffins, or going on Facebook to talk to my buddy down the street, how does it make me part of the hive mind, the singularity religion?
Well, what happens with Google, first of all, I don't have any problem with Google search. And
And duly noted, you've got a Microsoft connection. They've got Bing. Okay.
I've got a Google connection too. I helped sell them a company that I was part of, and I've known them since they were kids. And
duly noted. All on the table.
All right. And there's nothing wrong with search, and there's nothing wrong with your brand muffin adventure. That's all great. The problem is that in the big picture, what happens is you start to merge everybody's expression into this one big mush. So you put some music out there, and it's true, you might get some kudos because a lot of people see your YouTube mm-hmm. video or something, mm-hmm. but then gradually it'll get mixed into a bunch of streams. Like just the other day, somebody was trying to track down some stuff that I had written and some photographs that were taken of me, and we couldn't find the photographer. And it's these are photos posted all over mm-hmm. the place, but the link
the
to the origin has been lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so, meanwhile, there's this problem of elevating advertising into something that has like this superior status. You're expected online to see everything mashed up. What our words today might be turned into some mashup lounge music by somebody, mm-hmm. and that's supposed to be normal. But no one dares touch the advertising. The advertising that shows up in the column on the side of your window is like the sacrosanct thing. And the thing is, if you make advertising more important than primary expression, you gradually start to leech your own value. It's like the sort of off-color metaphor I use is it's like connecting a tube from one orifice to another to try to get nutrition, and it doesn't work,
So if what you or I write or say or create online, that's mash-upable. That's kind of the anonymous feedstock for this thing you're saying. Advertising held to a different – but how does going on Facebook make me part of a hive mind? I mean, it's my page. My wall.
Look,
friends come, they go.
I've had I haven't gone on Facebook myself, but my cat has. And, of course, I spent a lot of time with a lot of people who go on Facebook. And so far as I can tell, there's two different Facebook experiences, roughly. A person who already has a life, they have kids and a job or something, they go on Facebook and they reintroduce themselves to their past. And it all kind of makes sense. The person who's just coming up in the world, who's 14 or 15, gets a Facebook page. That's a different story. Then what happens is they create this cartoon version of themselves that then becomes the guide. Instead, it puts the cart before the horse, if you like, where the abstraction of the person starts to be the thing that operates real life. And so you start, like the classic example is that the idea of friends mm-hmm. has been reduced because now you have these abstract friends who you don't even know. And keeping that all straight. But, the thing that really bugs me is the capacity for reinvention for kids has been really reduced. Like, you can't imagine a Jack Kerouac with a Facebook page because wherever he'd go on the road, mm-hmm. people would just Google him. And there's no ability to reinvent yourself. You can't have the Bob Dylans. You can't have America is based on forgetting people. It's what we do is we forget our past and we reinvent ourselves. And now what we're doing with Facebook is we're making these abstract, like, records of ourselves. And the only business motivation for it is to attract these advertisers. And so what we're doing is we're kind of selling leeching our own ability to reinvent ourselves for the sake of this advertising business, which in itself can't sustain us into the future. So it's a very short-term thing.
No more Dharma bums out there. And above it all, you described as lords of cloud computing,
yeah.
looking down on digital peasants. And here's the economic part. You say it's going to be hard. It's already hard for musicians to make a living in the old way, certainly. It's gone. It's done. You say in the future, everybody's livelihood may be threatened by what's going on with the web, the reductionism?
Yeah. So right now, when we think of people who've lost their means of livelihood, we think of investigative journalists and musicians. And the reply to that is, oh, no, they're doing great. They can advertise themselves for free and then they can sell T-shirts or something. The problem with that is that eventually there'll be and eventually is not going to be too far in the future, 10 years or something, there'll be cheap robots that can make T-shirts off the internet, and then a custom T-shirt won't have any value either, just like a CD doesn't these days. So as technology gets better and better, these options where you retreat from trying to have a more and more cerebral way to make a living, they start to go away, and instead you have to dig farther and farther into the dirt to find a way to make a living, and it's just not a direction we can keep going on
People
forever.
May think it's just nature, but you say, no, this is the result of active decisions. This is an architecture, a design that let what you put on the web. You don't own it. It's not yours. It's just out there.
Well, you know, I actually think it's a result of a kind of a religious feeling. A lot of technologists, people who I'm close to, people who are friends, people who have been wonderfully sweet and gentle and generous with me over the years, a lot of them came to believe that the internet was this life form, that computers were a life form, and they're designing things for the benefit of this imaginary life form, which I don't even think exists. And
that it's is that the world brain, the sort of hive mind, the collective mind.
And it's really
mind.
That ideology that drove this. And it's true the advertising business is great for Google, but the origin of it actually comes from this other thing, this religious quest. It's basically the invention of a new religion, and it just doesn't happen to be one that serves people well.
We'll go out with a little music from Jaron Lanier and Mark Deutsch from the album Proof of Consciousness. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new pushback against the evolution of the web. Digital pioneer Jaron Lanier says the internet is now pushing us into a collectivist intellectual mush, turning individuals into widgets, digital peasants. His new book is You Are Not a Gadget, a Manifesto. In a few minutes, we'll hear from one of the authors of the Clue Train Manifesto from a few years back, but still influential, David Weinberger. Jaron Lanier is with me in the studio. It's been a long time since we've been together, but it's great to have you here. A lot of callers. Let's go to Anne in Barrington, Rhode Island. Anne, you're on the air with Jaron.
Hi, thank you so much. Actually, I agree with quite a bit of what you're saying, but it must be that for everything that's true, the opposite is also true. I have only in the last few years, because of the digitization of information, been able to find out really who I am. That is, I've called a couple of times with information I found about my African-American ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that I was African-American until I started doing some research that was only available to me in practical terms online.
So the web gave you a piece of yourself in that way.
It gave me my true self, absolutely who I am and who my father was and who my grandparents were and all the way back as far as I've been able to find to 1815. And it's gone beyond just even seeing censuses and things. With a lot of work, I could have gone from, you know, one National Archives source to another. But I've actually been able to see a law that my grandmother's brother helped write. It was in Jim Crow. It was to try to make things better for African Americans. I found out that my great-great-grandmother's husband was friends with Frederick Douglass. All this was information I found out because of digitization, and I was able to check it and recheck it to make sure it wasn't somebody else. And so it also has brought in a particularity about myself that I never would have had otherwise.
Absolutely. That's powerful testimony, Anne. And it seems on its face to go in the face of what you're saying, Jaron Lanier.
No. I love the internet. And listening to you talk gives me tingles. I'm so happy to hear your story. And this is one of many aspects of the internet that I'm just so happy have worked out so well. I'm not anti-net. It's very hard to try to shift the internet, to try to be partially critical, because there's so many people who say that if you don't like it exactly the way it is, you must be a Luddite, and nothing could be further from the truth. And I'm so glad you told us your story, because
individuality. She found particularity, not hive mind,
absolutely.
On the web.
Absolutely. No, the internet in itself and the web in itself are wonderful, and I'm very careful in the book to distinguish those things from the Web 2.0 stuff, which is much more recent.
Describe for people who may not be web 1990s, what you mean by Web 2.0 and what happened in that transition.
Well, Web 2.0 is this notion that you collect people together, you aggregate them together so that you lose information instead of keeping it, and you start to lose who they are. You get little fragments of contributions from them, and you turn them into these feeds, what I call a mush, and then you use that aggregate result to sell advertising. In a sense, I think it's exactly the opposite of the story we just heard, because you're losing the individual story. But this was a wonderful story about what's best about the internet and exactly what I don't want to lose.
Let's go to Jake in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Jake, you're on the air with Jara and Lanier.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I actually wanted to, I do have a comment, but I'd like to comment on what your last caller said, and I won't spend a lot of time, but I feel like age might have a lot to do with the want to go look for that kind of information, and that might play into, you know, a younger generation may not see the internet as that, and I couldn't agree more with your guest in that regard, but my question is...
You there, Jake? Jake, stay on the earth with us. Are you there? Jake's been
He's been swallowed by the hive mind.
The
internet is coming alive and is starting to steal the souls of your callers.
Let me ask you then. Here's I'm looking at Slate. They're kind of snarky about this. I mean, they admire parts of what you're writing. You know, they sort
yeah,
of.
Yeah, I heard about that one. I haven't read it though.
Oh, they say Jared Lanier. He's the epitome of the hippie shaman guru strain in tech culture. Lovely dreads.
I'll take that.
But he says these to a bit of Jake's point. He says these musings are the kinds of nostalgic observations that are ridiculous to anyone young. He says that Lanier is a romantic snob. His critique is ultimately a particular brand of snobbery.
Well, you know what I've noticed about the demographic of people who've been sending me emails about the book is that there's, I don't know how old the person who wrote that is, but a lot of the ones who identify themselves with youths are actually my age. And this is what I call youthiness in honor of truthiness, where there's a whole lot of people online who are pundits who pretend to be speaking for youth who are actually the same generation as me. A lot of younger kids actually have been writing me letters saying, you know, I feel so scared about Facebook. I feel scared about my reputation. And there's a very different experience. So I actually think there's something of an inversion. And as far as being a snob... yeah, sure. I'll take it.
Let's go to Glenn in Russellville, Kentucky. Glenn, you're on the air.
How y'all doing?
Hi, we're pretty well. What do you see, Glenn?
Well, you know, the thing about the internet, there's a lot of good things about the internet. There are a lot of bad things. You know, you always have people to take advantage of the good of in anything. I would just like to comment about, you know, for me, I'm an older gentleman. The internet is a great tool if it's not misused. I was listening to the caller talking about her ancestry, and I'm about ready to partake of that investigation through the internet for myself to find out my history.
Yes, sir.
And it's just a great thing. And like I said, you know, it's meant for good, but people want to take advantage of everything. It's like you have pedophiles and things that use it for the bad.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of good things the internet is good for, but some people overuse it as well.
Russell, it's great to have your call, and I appreciate that very much. And I want to twin it up with one more right here. You call yourself an older gentleman. Let's get a younger woman, if I may. Anne in Norton, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had a question for your guest, and I hope you could comment a little bit about the protection of Facebook users. I myself do not have any networking affiliation. I'm not on MySpace, Twitter, or Facebook because I have heard that Facebook has the right to distribute your information, pictures, comments, in whatever way they choose. And not too much has come out about this quite yet, but I was wondering if he foresees down the line, if there's no sort of user protection for our personal information, you know, will we really become homogenized and sold off to all these marketing companies? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much, Anne. Generally, we've got Russell there, our caller in Kentucky, and then Anne here. It's just a great thing, he says, but of course it could be misused. And Anne wanting to know, can she protect herself? What about the basic? What about that? And the basic structure, which you say could be different. How?
Facebook is always tweaking their privacy policies, and the reason why is that they're still chasing this mythical advertiser who will show up someday. The notion is that if you can capture peer group pressure is supposed to be the very most powerful molder of human character. So if you can capture people when they're forming peer groups, you could advertise to them perfectly. And so there's this dream. I hope I'm not sounding mean. I actually know the Facebook kids, and I like them, the who started it. But the thing is, as far as protection on Facebook, there's protection for geeks. If you're technical enough to be able to go through their system and really understand what it's doing, and it actually has gotten complicated enough that it's almost like an act of programming a computer
to do it, mm-hmm.
to be able to operate Facebook properly. So if you're a geek, you're protected. Basically, what we're doing is we're elevating our own status in society versus people who aren't good at being geeky, and that's the current state.
How could you have changed the structure or built it differently of the internet, Web 2.0? You say there's a problem with, what do you call it, freezing or not freezing? Things get
locked in,
freezing.
Yeah.
So you say you get a certain program or structure here to what's going on, and then everybody starts using it. It's hard to change. How could it have been built differently, and what might that have looked like? How might it still be different?
Well, you know, there are wonderful alternatives to collectivization. For instance, before the rise of Wikipedia, there was a thing called there was a thing called ThinkQuest that was hugely popular, which was a contest for people to make websites that were specialized on a topic. And people made these wonderful things instead of a collective entry for Facebook, which is really impossible because there's no single point of view on a lot of topics. There would be entries created that were of a point of view, but of just extraordinary quality. And Wikipedia just kind of killed it. And it's also kind of killed the whole function of search engines because everything is just Wikipedia first and advertiser second now. So there are a lot of designs that are better than the Hive mush designs that have become popular. We've already built them. We've seen them. And the Hive mush stuff isn't even making money. I mean, Facebook isn't even a business success. So we've really made a wrong turn, but it's a very recent one, and it's one that's correctable. And by the way, there's a lot of good stuff on Facebook, too, and a lot of the things that people enjoy about being able to keep up with friends could be completely preserved in a non-mush design. So I'm not absolutely opposed to every little thing about all this stuff. And I think also a lot of people can use it and have great experiences and use the stuff really intelligently. So this is not an absolutist or extreme argument. Mm. I do think we need to change the stuff because software does get locked in and gets hard to change after a while.
Jaron Lanier is author of the new book, You Are Not a Gadget, A Manifesto. We've got another manifesto writer with us today, and very happy to have David Weinberger is here. He's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's one of the authors, four or five of them, of the Clue Train Manifesto. The End of Business as Usual came out in book form in 2000, very influential among a lot of people in the business community and beyond, and sort of came out around the same time as Web 2.0 made its big entry. David Weinberger, great to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, Jaron Lanier has been in this world for a long time. You've been watching it for a long time as well. He sees the rise of digital Maoism, of a kind of users being turned into peasants, to the overlords of cloud computing. Have we taken a wrong turn in the web, or is Jaron misreading what you see?
Well, I think we've taken every possible turn just about. And so, sure, there's much of what Jaron describes is true, and it's something to worry about, but it's not a complete picture. In fact, I don't think it's a good characterization overall of what's going on. I see it very differently.
Well, are we being herded into a collective sort of view of the world, devaluation of the individual, sort of being locked in Borg-like to the hive mind here?
Overall, no. There are absolutely elements of that. But if you're going to talk about the internet, then I think that takes us down the wrong path of thinking about it. In fact, there's so much disagreement on the web. There's so many the pre-Wikipedia site that allowed people to set up their own sites in an area of expertise mm-hmm. is replicated literally millions and millions of times on the web as people set up their own sites. It's there. It's just so much easier now, which is in fact what Web 2.0 is about. It's the ease with which users who are not experts, who are not programmers, can set up a site in order to express themselves individually and in connection with other people. I think Jaron is very concerned about a type of reductionism, which I both see and in a sense, don't worry about too much.
Meaning, so, I think if I, you know, that I'm just my sort of whatever boxes I've checked on Facebook, or I'm sort of reduced in that way, for example.
Yes, I mean, it shows up in a number of ways in what Jaron's been mm-hmm. writing and talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly one of them. Friendship becomes this thin thing that's just mediated by mere bits mm-hmm. and just a profile that we get moved up into the aggregate where the individuality drops out and we get sold to advertisers.
We're faceless. Mm-hmm.
We're faceless. Mm-hmm. And there are apps, of course, there are elements of that. But this type of reductionism, I think, misses as a characterization of the web, which from my point of view is all about the rejection of the old information age reductionism, which was a real reductionism.
Like?
Bits and bytes. I am not a number. Do not fold, spindle, mutilate. Mm-hmm. The whole fear, the proper fear that you're being reduced to what fit into a database and the rest of it was being ignored.
Slept off.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. And the web, I think, is actually a strong reaction against that. It is this overflowing, this overwhelming torrent of individuals speaking and forming groups and speaking as groups. And at every level, it seems to me that it's just this overwhelming and transcendent reaction against this previous ages reductionism.
Let's hear the digital Roddy conversation then. Learn, Jaron, what do you say to David? Sees it just the other way.
Well, no, I mean, I actually don't think we're that far apart. And
there's a hive mind; it's kind of dominating, or there's not.
Economically, the hive mind's dominating. I mean, if you look at previous ages of technology, there was quite a distribution of different companies that were making money. And in the Web 2.0 companies, there's basically Google and companies trying to be bought by Google. There's another way to put it is that the long tail is very thin in that world as far as economics and also as far as searchability. That it's true there's just more and more and more pages. But created by people, but they become invisible. And if you're
why do you become invisible when you create a web page?
Because if you're on the 27th page in the Google result, then you're effectively invisible, right? And so the problem is that this particular design, and I don't mean to be ratting on Google, because actually that's not exactly the problem. It's more the way aggregate content has been fed to the Google search engine, and I in my book I have a thing about search being hogged by this kind of stuff, so that the other stuff becomes less visible.
David, what if you're so deep in Google that you just don't you may have a page, but nobody sees it? It's on page 27 of all those search responses.
It's just a fact of the layout of pages that there's only going to be one top page in Google. So necessarily a small number of people compared to the number of people producing are going to show up. But to think that that is all that matters is to adopt a broadcast era model that says that it only matters if you are one of the top 10, if you're one of the big broadcasters, if you're one of the mega stations. And in this new economy of ideas, it's so much compared to the previous broadcast era. It's so easy now for people to set up a site or to go onto another site to express themselves, to connect with other people, that there's a whole other economy
going on. That there's one other thing which you need aside from that, which is you need to be able to make your rent. And so the problem is that we've divorced this activity, which I completely agree with you that it's there and it's easier than ever and it's wonderful. And we actually are in complete agreement about that. And in the book, I try to make a big fuss about how much I adore that aspect of the present internet. But we've divorced the mental and emotional and spiritual life from the economic life, which is impoverishing those people where this collectivization has already hit. So the point is that the trajectory is headed towards disaster and it really is not sustainable.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new pushback against the evolution of the internet, the web. Digital pioneer Jaron Lanier says the internet is now pushing us into a collectivist mush, turning individuals into digital peasants. His new book is You Are Not a Gadget, a manifesto. David Weinberger is also with us today from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. He's one of the authors of the Clue Train Manifesto, came out in book form in 2000. In a few minutes, we're going to turn to the latest from the earthquake front in Haiti. A lot of people responding to this theme, though, as well. Here, Jaron, David from Facebook. Kelly says, it can be argued that the internet threatens our cohesion as a people, not our individuality. As gadgets replace in-person contact, we lose valuable human closeness with each other and stand alone
more than ever before. And maybe on that same front, let me get a call from Salt Lake City, Utah. Marty, you're on the air.
I'd like to make a comment about Facebook and its effect on the social atmosphere for the younger generation. Mm-hmm. I'm 28 years old, and I feel that if I'm not on Facebook or MySpace or Twitter, then I'm at a social disadvantage when it comes to meeting people, forming relationships, or even maintaining relationships.
No doubt, yeah.
Because a lot of the individuals that I speak with, a majority of their communication skills or communication methods are through these websites, and it's almost intrusive to the actual in-person communication because they're on their smartphones, jumping on Facebook, checking it out, doing those types of things.
So you're kind of, I guess, reduced to the interaction that Facebook allows you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you look at, you're going out to meet somebody, let's say, because I'm a single male, you know, in the Salt Lake area. If I end up trying to meet somebody, let's say, just in the social atmosphere, I feel as if I don't know this person until I check their Facebook, until I see what they're doing on Twitter. You know, you feel that you find that, you know, this person is someone completely different than what they are in person, or they're just not as articulate in person as they are on the Internet.
Marty, you're great. And plenty articulate. Let us pick it up. Jeremy, this goes right to your thing. You say beware. Computer programming very quickly jumps from, you know, let's say the web into our lives and the sort of framework of our interactions.
Yeah. Well, let me address the first point from the previous caller, which is this question of social cohesion. What I've noticed in online mush-like communities is that people tend to separate themselves into bubbles that don't, and they don't cross across the bubble boundary. So the Tea Party people talk to Tea Party people, but they don't really have to talk to anyone else anymore. Mm-hmm. And lefty crazies in Berkeley, where I live, do exactly the same thing. And I think that's really unfortunate. And so even though there's all of this mixing and connection possible on the Internet, what seems to be happening in practice, but really only with these designs that I dislike, is that people are separating themselves into red and blue and a bunch of other distinctions. And then this last caller, I mean, I think he gave us a very honest and straightforward picture of both the good and the bad things about it. And what I'm saying is not that it's all bad, but that the bad stuff is really bad, and let's try to keep the good and get rid of the bad.
David Weinberger, Jaron writes, says, different media designs stimulate different potentials in human nature. I mean, if you think about it, we live in a media era. That's a big deal. We shouldn't seek to make the pack mentality as efficient as possible, which he may be tagging Facebook, et cetera, with. We should instead seek to inspire the phenomenon of individual intelligence. And then he writes, being a person is not a pat formula, but a quest, a mystery, a leap of faith.
And it's also a social activity.
Yes.
The notion that we're individuals first, which is in your very first page
mm-hmm.
of the book, that we're individuals first is a point of view, but it's not necessarily the only point of view. It's certainly arguable that we are fundamentally social animals and that this new environment is a better, not a perfect by any means, but a better reflection of that social nature. It is, of course, influenced heavily by the decisions that software makers make and that policymakers make as well. But of course it is. But those decisions also reflect and are taken up by humans in their own particular way. And very quick example. So Twitter was designed mm-hmm. They had one particular thing in mind, as I understand it, which is you're young, you have a cell phone, you want to meet up with your friends and stay in touch with them. That was transcended, overwhelmed by other uses as more and more people came onto it with different ideas. So the software is to some degree, not entirely, you're absolutely right. I mean, it has some functions, not others, but the software can be taken over and transcended by the individuals who are using them to use their own things.
But in a roundabout way, when you say maybe we're social first, not individuals first, I mean, there is quite a... There's quite a canon of individuality in all culture and Western culture. You seem, in a way, to be seconding Jaron's notion. We're moving more toward the social existence, the hive mind, maybe.
Well, it's not hive mind. So, yes, I do think that that the net enables us to be more social, and I think that this is a reflection of what's best in us, so that what comes out of it is not simply hive mind where everyone agrees and we walk in lockstep, but, in fact, this enormous exposure of the differences we've always had, but now we're able to be different, to differ and to connect at the same time.
Jaron, is that the digital Maoism you bemoan, Jaron?
Well, the digital Maoism is the idea that instead of making a living by being an intellectual, you're sent back to the fields. You have to sell T-shirts and tour instead of selling CDs. So that's what digital now is.
If you're a musician.
If you're a musician, and eventually for everybody. But let me comment on this question of individual versus pack. Mm-hmm. In the book, I have the latter part of the book is actually about science and not about this stuff. And one aspect of it is a speculation that humans evolved to be able to switch between modes, between social and individual modes. And indeed, we can survive either way. And there are a lot of creatures like this that have evolved with this switch. And the thing is, there's a pack switch that can happen. When you follow people online, if there's a group of people interacting, you can see this moment when they can turn into a mob. And that's when we get the phenomenon of trolling and meanness. The problem is it just happens for the human species that the collective behavior is often quite nasty, and individual responsibility tends to bring out better qualities. And so this is not an absolute abstract principle for all possible species in the universe, but I think more of an observation empirically about the biology of people.
But also about the structure of the Internet where we have anonymity. This was designed. This isn't handed down from the heaven.
There was a choice to make the Internet more anonymous than it might have been, and there are a whole bunch of interesting sociological and even religious fantasies that led into that choice. But this combination of anonymity and social mixing can bring out the worst in people. So it's absolutely true that it's an authentic part of human nature, but it's not necessarily always the best part, and so it does concern me.
Let me get one more call. Fort Myers, Florida. Carl, you're on the air, Carl.
Hi, yes. I had an observation, I guess. I'm 33 years old. I've been a computer geek since I was a kid, so I remember BBSs with and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole aspect of the masses now accessing the web. I remember when the Internet was a place where only people who knew how to write HTML and stuff could even really get on there or do anything or express themselves on it. Mm. Otherwise, it was a purely viewer-only environment. This whole backlash, I guess, against the fact that it's becoming just this standardized mashup where people just put on trivial things, isn't that maybe just a simple result that the content providers are now massively outnumbered by the users, but everybody's got the tools to become a content provider and they simply have nothing to provide?
Carl, we've just got a couple minutes. Let us pick it up. Jaron?
My nightmare is that people aren't actually creative, but I think the truth is that they are. I think what we've seen on the Internet so far is just an incredible positive result about how much a vast number of people have to contribute and how much people want to contribute. And the net should be designed to celebrate that.
But we're not. You write, you say, it's as if culture froze just before it became digitally open. And all we can do now is mine the past like salvagers picking over a garbage dump.
That's you. I know, it's me. That's a different part of the book where I'm talking about the extraordinary way that we pick over culture as it existed before the web to remash it and how relatively there's less new stuff. And that is a problem online, too.
Music is mashups. It's not necessarily new. David, maybe we just go off into a hive mind future. It becomes what we are, more social, more tied together, less individual. Is that what you're projecting?
I think it's a reflection of how we've always been.
Mm-hmm.
It's now easier to do, and we can see it, whereas we couldn't see it before. And we could not before see what people were talking about in their local bar or restaurant, which would tend to be trivial and not a lot of disagreement, right? People aren't generally arguing.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, but mm-hmm. What do you think? And the mm-hmm. minor differences, but we can now see that. And because we can see it, we're shocked. We're shocked that mm-hmm. people talk about things that are trivial to us.
And are mean
and agree with one another more than they disagree. Well, that's how it is. That's how society, that's what makes a society, and the reuse of culture is what makes culture.
I still have my ideology from the old days that everybody's a genius in some way and everybody has something valuable to share. And if the Internet is set up to reward them, everybody can make a living off their brains. I really believe that as much as I did when I was a kid.
With that, we're out of time. It's a great conversation, and I hope we can pick it up again. I'm very grateful to each of you for being with us. David Weinberger, co-author of the Clue Train Manifesto. Thank you so much for coming in today, David.
Thank you.
Jaron Lanier, it's wonderful to see you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much.
Jaron Lanier is author of the new book, You Are Not a Gadget, a Manifesto. In a moment, we'll hear the latest on the earthquake in Haiti. This is On Point. We turn now to the latest on the situation in Haiti following the devastating earthquake that struck there yesterday. We've heard the anguish from the streets. Joining us now from Miami is Carol Rosenberg, correspondent with the Miami Herald. She's part of the team that's been reporting on the earthquake since word first broke of its occurrence at 5 p.m. yesterday. Carol, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So what do we know at this point about the scale of the quake and the damage it has caused?
Well, this, as you know, Haiti has a fragile infrastructure that was and a fragile economy and only a recently consolidated central government. The National Palace imploded and the President René Préval went missing for a while. The UN mission headquarters collapsed and peacekeepers have been looking for their fellow UN mission members and the mission chief. The parliament building has been damaged. The tax office has collapsed. We heard just this morning the President Préval called the Miami Herald and we heard that schools have collapsed, hospitals have collapsed. The military and State Department here are just mobilizing aid to Port-au-Prince. We hear that President Obama and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon consulted overnight. You know, Haiti, for Haiti coming off of four back-to-back hurricanes a couple of years ago, this is just a catastrophe heaped on a disaster. We have no casualty counts. We're just hearing that the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Port-au-Prince may be dead. The institutions of society that would be responding to this earthquake are just trying to pull themselves together and start counting the dead and rescue the living and wounded.
The epicenter within 10 miles of the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. Communication still very tough from Haiti. What are you seeing in the images that are coming out, Carol?
We're seeing collapsed buildings. We're seeing dead bodies. We're seeing, obviously, anguish and people frantically looking for their family members. We've seen the crushed presidential palace. I mean, the pictures came out through the social networking sites through Twitter starting last night, and you're right, the phone lines are down. We're getting reports through the web and through phone calls out with phone calls in, very, very difficult.
The United Nations now is reporting that the main prison in Haiti's capital has collapsed with reports of escaped inmates. I mean, you spoke of the institutions of society and government in shambles. It looks like an unbelievable rebuilding challenge here.
And remember, Tom, that's why the UN was there. The UN was there to bolster a government that was just centralizing and getting it together. And with the UN in its own having its own tragedy, we really need to watch and see how they're going to put the pieces back together. On the prison collapse and escape, we're still working on confirming that. We have not yet confirmed that, but the institutions of society are just imploding down there.
President Obama made a statement this morning on the situation in Haiti. Let's listen.
This is a time when we are reminded of the common humanity that we all share. With just a few hundred miles of ocean between us and a long history that binds us together, Haitians are our neighbors in the Americas and here at home. So we have to be there for them in their hour of need.
Carol Rosenberg joins us with the Miami Herald. There's President Obama. As you say, there are no counts on casualties yet. Are there estimates, Carol? Do we have any idea whether we're going to be talking hundreds or thousands?
President René Préval reached out to us this morning, and he estimated thousands of dead. But, you know, really the hard work of rescuing those who are still alive and counting the dead has barely begun because planes have just started landing in Port-au-Prince or have just started taking off from South Florida for Port-au-Prince. Nobody got in there overnight. And given Haiti's bad infrastructure, bad communication, and traditional sort of chaos that they have been trying to stitch together into a central government, reliable numbers will be days in coming.
President Obama says that the U.S. will be there for them in their hour of need. What do you expect the most immediate needs will be at scale, Carol?
Well, we anticipate military and relief flights bringing in water, tents, food, and the basics of survival, which is what they've always had pre-positioned down in the Caribbean and ready to go for Haiti and other countries down there reeling from natural disasters. After that, or in parallel, we know there's a call for heavy equipment to start moving rubble and clearing out, and teams that can search and rescue teams that can find the living underneath. And, of course, medical supplies. We have medical, we have doctors and nurses in South Florida trying to get down there to assist in helping those who have survived this tragedy.
The International Red Cross says a third of Haiti's 9 million people may need emergency aid. Do you have a sense of how wide a portion of the country geographically has been affected by this beyond Port-au-Prince?
Well, that seems to be the one bright spot in all this, for what it's worth. We hear this really was focused on the capital, and that the people outside the countryside, well, they felt it, of course, and didn't bear the brunt of the damage. I mean, there are shanty towns in Port-au-Prince, which you would expect would be rattled and damaged in an earthquake, but solid structures, or more solid structures, in the capital, Port-au-Prince, like the UN mission headquarters, like the National Palace, they suffered extreme damage. And we understand that the worst of it is really focused in the capital.
When might air traffic be able to get in there in volume? Do you know, Carol?
I don't know about in volume, but we have reporters in the air right now on their way into Port-au-Prince, and we expect live reports later today.
A major, major earthquake in Haiti and major devastation. Carol Rosenberg is a correspondent with the Miami Herald, joining us from Miami. Their staff, as she said, headed to Port-au-Prince into Haiti right now. Carol, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Carol Rosenberg, the Miami Herald. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Say a prayer for Haiti. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.